Greetings and neurolithic tessellations, my resoundingly novel annular listeners, and welcome to this January 2017 Science News Update. I'm your host for this appallingly indiscriminate science podcast segment, Jim Campanella. Happy New Year to you one and all. May this be the biggest and bestest New Year that ever there was. Let's start out with an older story. I meant to tell you about, well, way back. Way back last April, actually. Alright, sorry, I missed it among all the other stuff. That happens. Still an interesting one. A doctoral candidate at University of California, Miai Lei Tai, yes, she's not a PhD yet, discovered something interesting in her thesis work. Her findings were published last April 25th, 2016, in the American Chemical Society's Energy Letters. So, what did she find? Well, it appears that she may have accidentally invented a nanowire-based battery capable of lasting 400 times longer than any of the best-performing batteries currently on the market. See, most batteries use lithium to carry and hold electric charges, and you guys all have lithium-ion batteries. However, there's a major downfall with lithium-ion batteries. Every time the battery gets charged and discharged, the lithium inside the battery corrodes a little bit more, causing the lithium to become more brittle and to crack, and it makes the battery more unstable and unusable after just a couple years. Additionally, as the battery ages and the lithium corrodes more, it discharges faster, it doesn't hold a charge for as long a period, and so it becomes fairly useless. Translation: even if your iPhone has 64 gigs and works perfectly, you need to buy a new iPhone after 3 years or so because Apple does not make the battery replaceable, and so we all lose out. At any rate, researchers have been trying for a while to employ nanowires instead of lithium to make batteries. Nanowires are extremely delicate wires, thousands of times thinner than a human hair, and they have basically the ideal characteristics for use in batteries. They're very conductible, they have a very high surface area that can help the movement and storage of electrons. Nevertheless, these little tiny filaments of nanowires are extremely fragile, so they don't hold up very well to continuous charging and discharging. Apparently, Ms. Tai has stumbled upon a solution by coating gold nanowires with a manganese dioxide shell and suspending it in an electrolyte plexiglass-like gel. The new setup keeps the properties of the nanowires in place, and the wires don't fracture through use over and over again. Tai tested the charging capacity of the electrode nearly 200,000 times over a three-month period. She found the system to be extremely resilient and resistant to failure, with none of the nanowires fracturing. She says, quote, "I was just playing around. I coated this whole thing with a very thin gel layer and started to cycle it. I discovered that just by using this gel, we could cycle it hundreds of thousands of times without losing any capacity," unquote. The surprising part is that the researchers still aren't exactly sure how their newly developed technology works. Tai said, quote, "We started to cycle the devices, and then we realized that the batteries weren't going to die. We were incredibly excited, but we don't have any idea how the mechanism works yet," unquote. This sounds great, doesn't it? But there's always a catch, isn't there? What's the catch here? Well, since Tai's batteries were made using gold, they would be very expensive to purchase for an iPhone or anything else for that matter. So Tai and her doctoral advisor are already trying the same experiment using nickel instead of gold to see whether they can generate similar results. Even so, this is a serious breakthrough. In every interview I've read, Tai seems to be grateful with her find, and presumably not just because it pretty much guarantees her a doctorate and an academic job anywhere she likes. Sorry, my cynical side is showing through. She finished the article by saying, quote, "This research process proves that a nanowire-based battery electrode can have a long lifetime, and that we can make these kinds of batteries a reality," unquote. Next story. Better uses for drugs than what they were originally designed for. Longtime listeners will know that my father has Alzheimer's. Yes, it has been hard on the family, and especially hard for my mother, but that is certainly not what this story is about. In the last year, my dad has been given a variety of pro-cognitive, quote-unquote, anti-Alzheimer medications that have done absolutely nothing to better his mental condition. I am not in a position to say whether my dad is simply in too advanced a state to benefit, or whether, as my mother believes, the drugs are simply crap. Actually, that was my word, not my mother's. My mother was a bit more vehement on the subject and even more colorful in her native Sicilian. So I was both saddened and a bit heartened by the following story. In a study published January 9th in Scientific Reports, Dr. Paul Sharp of King's College in London found that applying tideglucib, an Alzheimer's drug, which did not help my dad, can successfully promote teeth to repair themselves, at least in mice. Sharp says, quote, "Almost everyone on the planet has tooth decay at some time. It's a massive volume of people being treated. We think we could dispense with all that drilling and filling. Normally, when a tooth loses dentin, that's the bony layer under the enamel, stem cells deep in their pulpy centers can help regrow that lost tissue. Normally, this mechanism is only able to repair small cavities and cracks. Using tideglucib, we've deliberately tried to make something really simple, really quick, and really cheap," unquote. Sharp and his team conducted the study on mice, drilling holes in their little tiny teeth and filling the cavities with a biodegradable, drug-soaked sponge. I know, just thinking about that makes me uncomfortable. Shades of the crazy Nazi dentist for the 1970s movie Marathon Man. Is it safe? Ugh, sorry. Anyway. 6 weeks later, they found the treatment had helped the mice regrow the lost dentin in their teeth. The researchers are now testing whether the treatment can scale up to rat teeth and ultimately human teeth. At any rate, it's nice to see that an Alzheimer's drug may actually be able to do something useful. And yes, there is more than a bit of irony in that statement. So the story on tideglucib allows us to segue into a story that is actually related to it. Because tideglucib was originally tested on humans in trials over a number of years, and was long ago accepted into the United States FDA grouping of drugs that are safe for human use and treatment, it should actually be a relatively short time between clinical trials on human cavity treatment and marketing. If it works to help regrow human teeth, it may be marketed in the next year or two for that purpose. However, what about those drugs that are not so lucky and are still in initial clinical trials? For you Americans out there, European and British nannyism seems to be at a lower level than it is here. The FDA promised in the late 1990s to fast-track important drugs that could help in the treatment of cancers and all sorts of other horrible diseases. Did this happen? No, it didn't. An article this week in the journal The Scientist by Cary Grenz suggests that it is just as bad as it ever was. U.S. federal approval for new drugs now takes, hold on to your socks, about 12 years. Roughly the same length of time as it did in the late 1990s. Nothing has changed. So much for fast-tracking. And to make things worse, because drug makers are getting fewer years of exclusivity out of their patents, that may help explain the rising price of drugs. Gren says, quote, "Companies that cannot quickly push their drugs through the pipeline get a return on their investment later, creating incentive to charge more to make up for lost time. That also translates into fewer years on the market before a patent expires, which may also drive companies to charge even more to squeeze the most out of the time they have to reap big profits before the floodgates open to generic competition," unquote. Gren's article references a report from the Quintile IMS Institute that came out the first week of January, this year, obviously. The report analyzed 667 drugs approved for sale by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration since 1996. Approvals hit a low point in 2008, with just 19 new drugs joining the market. In 1997, and in 2015, approvals peaked at 47. Approvals dropped again in 2016, with only 22 new drugs approved. Cancer netted the biggest chunk of new medications during the past two decades, with about 18%, followed by infectious diseases, with about 14%, the Institute found. The success with cancer treatments may also influence drug prices, Grenz reported, because with a smaller market and no good alternative treatments, pharmaceutical firms can hike their prices and pretty much do whatever they like with them. 12 years. Seriously, 12 years. Let me put that in perspective. Your newborn of this year will be in seventh grade when drugs that are just entering trial in 2017 may be approved. Or better yet, my daughter will be 11 in May. Drugs that were starting trial when she was born in 2006 are still not approved. Imagine if a new drug is found today that has a major ameliorative effect on pancreatic cancer. It will not be on the market for more than a decade. All those lives lost in between just become what? Sad statistics? This doesn't seem very acceptable to me. I know that the FDA is trying to protect our lives and health, but there has to be a better way. I mean, there simply has to be a way to fix this mess we found ourselves in. Right now, the lives of lots of people are increasingly dependent on drugs which are still unapproved, even if they're effective. And yes, my anger does come in part from my own personal experience right now. I've read studies that demonstrate many potential effective treatments for Alzheimer's, but thanks to the FDA, none of those therapies will ever see the light of day in the U.S. in time to ever help my dad or anyone like him. Miffed? Disheartened? Annoyed? Pissed off? Bitter much, dude? Yeah, I'm all those things and a lot more. Here's a quote from Murray Atkin, executive director of Quintile IMS Institute. He says, quote, "I was personally surprised it still takes an average of 12 years for drugs to hit the market. We haven't seen as much progress in revolutionizing the approach to clinical development that we might have expected 20 years ago," unquote. Well, thank you, Murray, a.k.a. Captain Obvious. Since we seem to be on a roll here as kind of a theme, let's keep that up. I said I'd read several studies that were very promising in terms of Alzheimer treatment. Can I give you an example? How about this one? Dr. Ruben Cauchi, senior lecturer at the University of Malta, has reported in the journal Neuroscience Letters last month that his research group may have finally found some extracts of plants that have a significant effect on Alzheimer's, at least in animal models right now. Chemicals extracted from the prickly pear and brown seaweed, two pervasive Mediterranean plants, have been elevated to possible drug candidates to combat neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. Those age-related disorders are both characterized by the accumulation of sticky protein clumps that over time damage the nervous system and erode mobility and memory, as many of you know. Cauchi says, quote, "We have been long screening plants scattered across the Mediterranean for small molecules that interfere with the buildup of toxic protein aggregates. The robust effects of chemicals derived from the prickly pear and brown seaweed confirm that our search has certainly not been in vain," unquote. Part of the motivation for this, Cauchi implied, was that in certain regions around the Mediterranean, there are populations that have very, very low levels of Alzheimer's, and they survive to very old age without evidence of neurodegenerative breakdown. And the idea is perhaps it has something to do with diet. So maybe there was something out there that people were eating, and so they've been studying plants in the area with the hopes of maybe finding something. They've been using fruit flies that have brain-specific expression models of both early and late-onset Alzheimer's, and they've been supplementing the food of the fruit flies with prickly pear or brown algae extract, and they found that it dramatically ameliorates the lifespan and the behavioral signs of the flies with these model problems. Additionally, they demonstrated that either extract prolonged the survival of a fruit fly model based on the transgenic expression of human alpha-synuclein, which creates the protein clots in the brain that cause Parkinson's disease. Regular treatment with the seaweed extract extended the median lifespan of the diseased flies by 2 days, and a greater 4-day extension was observed when prickly pear extract was administered. Now, you hear 2 days and 4 days, and that doesn't really seem like very much, but one of the things you have to consider is that 1 day in the life of a fruit fly is roughly equivalent to about a year in humans. So those results are pretty dramatic. The investigators also discovered that the extracted substances prolong the lifespan of flies with brains overloaded with that alpha-synuclein protein. It's a gummy protein that's associated with Parkinson's. And the effect of that gummy brain protein in a neurodegenerative mechanism is something that's shared by both Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. So at least in flies, the research team found that the plant-derived molecules interfered with the buildup of both beta-amyloid and that alpha-synuclein, their ability to generate clumps, which ultimately makes them toxic to neurons. Cauchy finishes with, quote, "We believe that the discovery of bioactive agents that target pathways that are hit by multiple neurodegenerative conditions is the most viable approach in our current fight against brain disorders. A clear advantage of the drugs used in the studies is that in view of their excellent safety profile, they are already on the market as nutraceuticals and cosmeceuticals," unquote. Neutral what? Well, a nutraceutical is a food used as a pharmaceutical. Huh. Well, let's put it this way. Because neither prickly pears nor brown algae count as drugs, the FDA will be able to do bugger all to stop doctors from using these plants as treatments. I like it. These Maltese are definitely on the right track. Well, I feel like I should do at least one more story this evening, staying as far away from biology as possible, and any emotional content as possible as well. How about this one? Dr. Michael Rensler of the University of Innsbruck reported in the journal Physical Review Letters at the end of December that his research group has generated the first negatively charged hydrogen ions, well, ever generated. This may not seem like a big deal, but even if you've just taken basic high school chemistry, you'll understand that this is a complicated thing and an important one. Hydrogen is the simplest of all the elements. It's made up of one proton in the nucleus with a single electron going around it. And the proton has a positive charge and the electron has a negative charge. So under most conditions, hydrogen is a neutral molecule because the two charges just cancel each other out, positive and negative. If the electron is lost by being knocked out of orbit, you have a barren proton for your hydrogen, and that is positively charged. So how is it possible to get negatively charged hydrogens? Well, Rensler infused tiny droplets of liquid helium with hydrogen gas. Then his team bombarded the droplets with a beam of electrons, which converted some hydrogen molecules into negatively charged hydrogen ions. Neighboring hydrogen ions, two bond hydrogen ions, clustered around the ion in groups of a few molecules to over 60. Rensler also determined the geometric structures of the clusters, hydrogen molecules organized into shells that surrounded the central ion. Clusters were the most stable and most common when molecules filled their shells to their capacity. In the first shell, for example, the cluster formed is an icosahedron, a 3D shape with 12 vertices, and that was when 12 molecules filled the shell. This is very cool. I've seen Rensler's 3D models. So are you going to come across these hydrogen ions in your garden, the Antarctic, the Amazon? No. The one thing to remember is that because all of this only occurs at near absolute zero, it will never occur naturally on Earth outside of a laboratory. However, in space, those negatively charged hydrogen cluster ions might form naturally in cold, dense clouds of hydrogen or in the atmospheres of gas giant planets. Well, that's all for me for now. As always, take care. Eat that prickly pear jelly if you want to keep your mind sharp. Petition the FDA to get their behinds in gear. Keep brushing your teeth. It'll be a while until Tideglucib will be there to help you. And I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.